All right, welcome to Greenspace. We're so delighted to be here with Lindsay Lerman. Lindsay Lerman is a writer, translator, and I think an utterly compelling thinker. She's got a couple of novels, I'm From Nowhere from Clash Books, and her second novel titled What Are You is right around the corner, due out this May, also from Clash Books. Lerman has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Guelph in Ontario, and you can find her on Twitter at Lindsay Lerman and Instagram at lindsay.lerman. So Jake is going to get us started in the conversation.
Cool. How's it going, Lindsay?
It's going well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to chat. I guess the second time we've actually chatted, which is exciting. Yes. So we have lots of questions that are kind of moving through various ways of engaging with art practice, but one thing I'm also really interested in is in kind of like daily forms of ritual or, you know, ways of accessing meaning, you know, in throughout like the mundane drudgery of daily life. Yes. So how do you access meaning or meaningfulness in your daily life?
It really depends on, well, first of all, the day, but it also depends on what I have going on in my life. Like if I'm in the middle of a really intensely creative period, I am kind of spacey about the rest of the world. You know, I kind of walk around in a fog and I don't do the usual things like, you know, take a moment to like notice that I'm making tea or notice that I'm doing the dishes. So those really intensely creative periods, I kind of become really useless and often unattached to everything. Then that can't last very long because that's not a very good way to live. So the rest of the time, it's like a lot of very small things. It's really as small, depending on how busy the day is. It can really be as small as like touching a plant that's in my living room and like just kind of saying hello to it and stopping to notice what my world is actually made up of, my material world especially. But then I'm very much a relationships person. Like my work is very solitary, but relationships are probably the most important thing to me after writing. So like the people that I live with, my partner and my daughter, and then my close friends that are very much family. So much meaning in our, you know, like even if it's our daily text exchanges or if it's like a long, long weekend lunch that we can all have together, it's people for the most part, other than the artwork.
That's great. I mean, our title is Green Space, so we're very pro touching plants and gardening, but also reaching out to people, connecting and sustaining relationships. Since you're talked about, you know, sort of these creative fogs that you're in, we'll just move to our big obnoxious question of why do you write?
Oh, I have forgot that you were going to ask me this one.
It's the worst.
So the answer has changed a lot over the course of my life, honestly. I don't always remember who I used to be, but I know I started writing like as a young child, because I was fascinated by the way shapes looked on the page when I made them and how that added up to a new reality. Maybe it's still the same now, but there's all these different dimensions now. It's so much more complicated, you know, like it's not just the pure thrill of what can I make happen on the page. You know, there's so much more in place now. But I think if I'm going to give a very critical answer, being critical of myself, that is, it's because like I'm kind of sick without it. And if I were to give a more generous reading of myself, it's because I ultimately like have a naive and kind of childlike belief in the possibility of communicating with other people.
Yeah, that, I mean, I think the tension there, right, between that sort of critical mode, you know, where we can see this as a certain form of sickness that we are compelled to commit to. But there is also within that the possibility of connection through these like weird solitary acts that I think that you're like driving right to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sometimes it's a form of sickness a little bit, but originally what I meant was that I'm sick without it. I'm like really unwell if I'm not doing it, if I'm not writing.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's a much healthier version of that I think speaks to my own understanding of it as a weird, yeah, compulsion. But that also then seems, right, like an investment in writing actually as a way of life that seems much more sustainable.
Yes, so absolutely.
In that way, then it becomes like a productive form of solitary engagement that also like fosters further community, as you were mentioning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I apologize for over-determining that through my vision of art practice at the moment.
No, it's really hard. It's really hard not to do that. It's really hard.
So with that kind of attention to where your practice is right now, what is it that you'd like your practice to look like, or what do you want it, your intellectual and artistic practice to look like in 20 years?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think that I can't describe the particulars, because the particulars could, they could change a lot. Like I could only be able to write on the weekends or late at night because I have to have a lot of other day jobs, or maybe it's possible for me to actually spend more time each day writing. Like all those particulars don't really matter so much. I can exist in either version of a possible life for me, but the larger, the sort of overarching picture that I really want to be in place is that, how to describe it? Like in the balance that is, the simultaneous growth and decay of life, I hope that artistic and intellectual growth are still dominant within me and my life, if that makes sense. I think it does.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just knowing that it's part of flourishing and vitality. And it reminds me of a quote in your review of Mackenzie Work's Censorious, where you write, "Do you remember the last time you encountered a concept that made your heart race? I'm serious, it's a real high, and it's really actually felt in the body, the rush of understanding something newly or in a new light for the first time." Which is just an amazing, way of describing like the phenomenology of something very exciting and intellectually vitalizing. So that leads us, to the next question of, we thought about the future and flourishing then, but what thinkers excite you or make your heart race right now?
Oh, so many make my heart race. I mean, honestly, that's the way that like my engagement with theory is a bit of a drug. It's a high that I end up chasing. And sometimes I end up chasing it too much. So I'm at a moment right now in my life, in addition to being in a sort of creative fallow period where I just really have to stop creating and just do a lot more assessing. I'm also not reading any theory because it gets me too excited and makes me want to start writing. I mean, like, honestly, in a way, almost every thinker I've ever encountered in my life has been exciting to me. But right now, It's a really deep pause. I'm doing a ton of like preparation for what comes next in my artistic and intellectual life. And it's sort of a big open field. And so I have like a lot of, I guess if we're talking about green spaces, like I have a lot of just like tending the soil to do because it's not ready for new seeds.
Is that related at all to your interest in non-knowledge?
I mean, yes, everything is related to my interest in non-knowledge. And non-knowledge is, it's the useless form of epistemic play that is the engine of all knowledge creation. So in a way, this moment is like, maybe this is a more playful moment for me where I'm just really like exploring an entire vast open field and territory in a very playful way and not committing to any one particular path or not thinking any one particular thought very deeply. Yeah, I think I like that. I think I like that answer.
Yeah, that idea of also like where you've connected, where you said the useless form of epistemic play, right? We have right here this kind of zone. It leads into two of our questions. I'll ask one, but I'm basically throwing the other one towards Joe in the process of our what is waste and what is leisure questions from Paul.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, right, this is circling around these questions as well. So maybe I'll just start with asking you, what is waste?
Waste is the way the universe functions. It's how the universe functions. Exuberance and waste. And leisure. Well, maybe I should wait and let you guys ask what you want to ask, or maybe you have a follow-up.
I mean, yes. I think putting them together is the best mode. Okay. In how you are right thinking of it already, especially as you were about to immediately transition into it.
I think
we need to continue and let that run.
And then I was like, don't, you know, let them ask, let them do, pace it out. I mean, I think mostly leisure is on the personal level, which is very different than, you know, the global level. But on a personal level, I think leisure is a moment when you're so saturated by the present that past and future fall away for just a moment. So you're sort of like, you know, really in the texture of the present. And I guess I should say, to tie it into the question of waste, those are the most wasteful moments. Right, because in a way we're kind of wasting what we think of as the unique capacities of human consciousness, which are probably not in fact that unique, but these capacities that we think we have uniquely as humans, you know, to be past oriented and future oriented, and, you know, to be world builders for precisely this reason, the wasteful moments when you're fully saturated by the present are moments when, you know, the things that are supposed to be special about us as humans totally disappear. And, you know, we're like Bataille would say, we're like animals. Like, you know, I think he says the animal is in the world, like water is in water.
In terms of these questions of waste and presentness, this now makes me curious to your own experience of art, philosophy, or writing. And, you know, one of our questions is, what would you like those things to do to you, your engagements with those? And now I'm wondering if it is related to this sort of space of play or this idea of an, you know, grounding present waste.
Yeah. I want them to do everything to me, you know, because to me, they're all very much living. You know, art is alive and theory is alive and music is alive. I want them to do everything to me. I want them to hurt me. I want them to heal me. I want them to challenge me. I want them to sharpen me. I want them to soften me. You know, I want them to be evidence of life, and I want them to be life acting on me and inspiring me and moving through me. And that's it. Everything.
No small demand, but
I know. Well, not like no one piece of art can do all of that, right? Every piece of art can do a few of those things, or maybe just one of those things. But, you know, taken as a whole, like my engagement with art and theory and the world and like gardening and friendships is, you know, cumulatively, it is that everything.
Hmm. Yeah, I like this idea of extending this idea of life, this sort of like vibrance and like hum to art and what we're hoping for it to do. We've been talking a lot about this, and then we have this like running metaphor we've been using of the space of the garden, right? Intending the soil, all these really organic kind of elements within our conversation, which like has left aside the larger framework, one in which we are currently embedded, right? Doing this all through this weirdly spatialized, distributed online conversation. So I'm interested, and this is a question we've taken from Bernadette Mayer's 1981 letter to Bill Berkson, which I just love the bluntness of the question and how it feels weird also now being totally extracted out of time. Asking this question, like, you know, over 40 years later, what do you think of machines?
Well, I don't know what I think of machines, because, like, there's nothing that isn't a machine. Do you know? And this isn't just the Deleuze and Guattari influence, right? This is also an an observation of like the organic world, the biological world. There's nothing that's not a machine. Everything has machinic properties. And so I have great respect for like machinic properties as one of the ways that life functions. And so like there are some aspects of this moment in time and in human history when, you know, we might have trouble meeting face to face and we can only meet through these machines, but like we were still meeting via machines earlier before. It was just a kind of a different understanding of machines. And so we're at this new moment in human consciousness that is a lot for us to process, I think. It's just we're all kind of struggling with like building the consciousness that can handle this particular quality of machinic interaction, because it's always been machinic before, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it seems like, right, the generally operative understanding of a machine is something that is still so visible to us. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think, as you're saying, right, there have been these other layers of machinic properties that are always present. We have some that seem not to fade into maybe our world quite as fluidly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fully automated, invisible epistemologies. What's something you believe that probably isn't true, Lindsay?
Oh, God. What can I say that's not going to really be that embarrassing? Well, this is the dark answer. Something that I still believe, even though it's probably not true, is that I can know myself and other people.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that has the possibility of being dark, or is like activates a certain type of hope. You know, within that also is like a little bit relieving to have that operating the space of like, I believe it, but it's probably not true.
Right. It takes a little bit of the pressure.
That's no longer my responsibility to fully know myself.
Right. I will try. I'll keep foolishly believing that it's possible, because it's important to be the fool. I believe that's really, really important to be the fool in life. But, you know, I guess, and part of the beauty of being the fool is that you can accept the inevitability of your defeat or your failure and oh, well, shrug it off a little bit.
I don't have any easy way of shifting towards our other questions, but we've been talking a lot kind of about this, you know, these like future speculative spaces, imagining your practice maybe as it could evolve moving forward. You know, I'd be interested to hear what you maybe think of as the poetry or writing or the medium of the future.
Oh God, as if I could know, right? If I could know, then I could go get rich, you know? I mean, there's the cynical answers that are like, that capitalism will find a way, or that, you know, the spectacle will find a way to get even deeper into our psyches, even deeper into our dreams and our desires, and God knows what that will bring. Like, maybe that's a cynical answer. And then there's probably a lighter answer, like, you know, innovation that is just so crazy that we wouldn't even believe it if someone told us, you know, just like someone, you know, 300 years ago, like try to describe to them what it would be like to hear like Jimi Hendrix playing the guitar or something, you know, something that would just like really seem quite literally impossible. It's going to be something like that, or it's going to be many somethings like that. And I don't know what I will live long enough to see, but I hope I live long enough to see like a lot of wild innovation, interesting innovation, and not just like brutal crushing other people in order to have like momentary selfish pleasures kind of innovation. Here's hoping, like a fool.
No, we're for it. This is why we ask the question. We are constantly trying to triage our own sense of hope. So we're very grateful. We want to offer our gratitude for offering a vision of that. You know, You cast backwards with Jimi Hendrix in order to explain perhaps what we would want from writing in the future. Let's go to music in the present and our final extremely selfish question. But we are building a playlist, and we will add these songs and share them at some point. What have you been listening to?
Yeah. Okay. So here's another, it's maybe going to be like a cop-out answer, but music is one of the biggest parts of my life, but my engagement with my own writing and with listening to music and with reading theory are all very tightly interwoven. And so when I'm in one of these fallow periods, I'm really not taking in a whole lot of new artistic and intellectual stimulus. But I have been listening to a friend of mine. She's a concert pianist, and she's going to have me read some poetry when she plays some Brahms next month. So I've been listening to a lot of the stuff that she's been recommending to me to kind of get me in the headspace of Brahms. And so I don't know the exact pieces. I could send them to you guys because I don't know the whole world of classical music as well as I'd like to. But yeah, that like very passionate, moody, beautiful, melancholic, romantic, dramatic sound. And it's been lovely to kind of soak in that.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I mean, it seems like good music for fallow period as well.
I mean, I think like the one thing that we kept like touching on, and I think you did when we pushed you towards the waste and leisure kind of questions, right? You ran with it in a way that was both really exciting just to listen to, but also like drew out something within that I thought was super fascinating, where you were pointing towards this being a perhaps something that is like working against our construction of the human, or like some sort of unique structure of the human. And I'm really interested in that as also kind of being your description of this space that you're carving out before embedding yourself deeply in a new artistic pursuit or new project perhaps. And I just was wondering if you had any kind of thoughts on that sort of resonance between this like preparatory state as you venture into a new artistic work and this being the like this like non-human sort of space of possibility or something like that.
I mean, I've never really thought of it in very clear terms like that, but yeah, maybe what I do in these kind of fallow periods, or what I think of as like vegetative, almost vegetative restful states, I haven't really thought of them as like my less human moments, but maybe they are. And well, I mean, there are also moments when I really, really connect, like I try to really deeply connect with, I guess what you would call the present moment, you know, like just spending a lot of time noticing, you know, my daughter, and like really getting to know her as deeply as I can and trying to understand her, and my partner, and like cooking elaborate meals for friends, and maybe just being very slow and deliberate. But then also, it also kind of feels like my antenna are way up, you know, like way high up. And so I kind of have to conserve my energy, because it's almost as though I've like cast myself up in a way to like gather as much information as I can while I'm very grounded in the present. That might sound a little bit insane. I'm not sure. But then I guess, no, that's probably all I should say for now, unless you have follow-up.
No, that's great. Yeah, that kind of, that attention to that receptivity, that openness, right, seems like a beautiful way of describing that kind of work you're doing prior to tending the soil and, you know, allowing these things to emerge from that.
Yeah. And I guess taking a moment, you know, to be present, because when I am really, really invested in a project, it's so hard to be fully present for everyone who I want to be fully present for, you know, that, like that's what I was talking about earlier, I guess, with being in a fog when I'm creating, is that it does sort of feel like I'm just like kind of wandering around and going about what I need to go about until I have the moment when I can get back to the project. And so, you know, those times I'm probably not the most attentive friend, you know, I'm probably not the best partner in the world then. I certainly try, but those moments I'm, in a way, I'm living for the thing I'm creating a little bit more than I'm living for everything else. So it's almost like I have these moments where I can, you know, make up for that and be like, look, on the whole, I'm here. It's just sometimes I can't be fully, fully here.
For listeners who want to be here for your work, what would you suggest they seek out? Where can they find your work?
Oh, well, I guess it depends on what they want. If they want, I mean, my first book is definitely available on Bookshop and Amazon and from the Clash Books website, and then also in bookstores. But my second book is going to be, it's going to be a little bit more widely distributed because the publisher that I've been working with, they just sort of picked up bigger distribution. So that will eventually hopefully be available in many bookstores, but also of course the usual places online. But then, I mean, I have essays and some short fiction up online. I think almost all of it is on my website, and interviews. I really love doing like in-depth interviews with other writers and artists. So I have a bunch of those up as well. And then I'm on Instagram, and then I'm going to do a couple of events in the spring and early summer to just kind of celebrate the second book, What Are You? So if people are in New York or on the East Coast, anywhere near Richmond, I'll be doing some events there.
I mean, thank you so much for spending time with these questions and for answering them with us. And I hope our listeners do check out your work. And I'm looking forward to digging deeper myself.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This is great. These were really good and really difficult questions. It's good to think through them. Thank you.